Hello and welcome to my AMA. This is Hedonistic Thrill, answering to all of your lovely questions. And I have with me, joining me as my questions master, the wonderful Moondon Smith. Me.
Good evening, everyone.
Okay.
Oh, you want a question?
Okay. I don't know.
Shall we go with a question then? I was just overawed by your voice there. You took me to a place I seldom reach, Thrill. You know, what can I say?
Yes, well done.
I'm now back in the real world, so just be careful because you have this way of doing things to me. So we'll start with question number one, shall we, before I get too carried away? I'll bet you do. Question number one. Let's start. This is from user LB Lithium Bomb. Okay, LB. He wants to know, let's start with the classic AMA question. How did you discover GWA and what made you decide to become a performer?
Everybody knows LB is a lover of classics. So how did I discover GWA? You know, that is a bit of a blur, I think. That I was down in a rabbit hole in one subreddit or the other. Mind you, not a Gone Wild subreddit, of course. It was not safe for work subreddit. Something to do with audio novellas, I believe. And one post led, quite literally, to another. And I found GWA and I was in awe because it had been everything that I had been looking for years, not knowing it had existed. Since for me, well, whenever I would watch porn, the one thing that I would get hung up on was dirty talk. And yeah, that's not exactly what you usually look for in visual porn, but I found a couple of videos which did that perfectly. So imagine finding a whole subreddit with such a rich flow of new content every single day, every single hour almost, and you're just a kid in a candy shop. So after a few months of just, well, again, that was a bit of a blur because it was one orgasm after the other. It's a good thing that it was during the first quarantine because other than that, I would not have had a very rich life back then. I just became enamored with the more artistic side of GWA. The side which demanded that performers bust out their acting chops, the side that had performers editing, doing different voices, using sound effects to create an immersive
and the rest they say is history.
That spoke to me and I thought, well, I would love to try my hand there.
And GWA,
and so I did.
GWA was certainly blessed by your prodigious talent, I must say.
I'm quite old enough to be history, but we're suddenly getting there.
He goes on then. Question number two. What is the deal with your R's?
And
personally,
so
I think you've got
blessed.
A gorgeous R's. Oh, R's. Why do they sound so hot?
Bits. Bit presumptuous there on you, Mindy. Well, my art.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. What is the deal with my art? I think only LB has actually used it, which is why I made fun of it in my post originally. Maybe
what is your favorite food? Question number three.
Do
you consider yourself to be
with my art,
adventurous when it comes to trying new foods?
Okay, let me handle your questions in the order in which they were presented. Why is it my favorite food? My favorite food is most certainly non-adventurous one. It's a comfort food to me. It just and I know this is going to piss a lot of people off. Whole wheat, yes, whole wheat, you heard me. Whole wheat pasta, preferably farfalle, with fresh cherry tomatoes cut on top, and a mountain of Parmesan cheese. Just heaven in a bowl. Anything fancy? No, you know what? Pasta is something to be worshipped. It is sacred. Do not blaspheme and actually confuse pasta and just bundle it up with other more ingredients. It's perfect the way it is. However, do I consider myself to be adventurous when it comes to trying new foods? Absolutely. I wasn't always that way, but a few years back, and I had that little click in the back of my mind, and since then, I would love to try the weirdest thing that I've never had before. Odd fusions that you weren't even aware they existed, like Ethiopian cuisine fused with Thai. Well, that is perfect for me. Let's do that. Let me have some of that. Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely adventurous when it comes to food. Food is another way to tantalize the senses, which is exactly why it is such a tough question to answer whether one would give up food or sex. They're both different forms of hedonism, after all.
Absolutely. Now, how did you come up with your username? That's an oldie but a goodie.
Oh, okay. How did I come up with my username? Well, one, practical reasons. What would you like the people addressing you to go by? Would you like them to be big boobs for you? Or would you like them to be conditioned to feel a certain way when addressing you? Thrilled. I know that that's what I went for.
That's a good answer.
First of all, it was that practical consideration. But more than that, hedonistic thrill. I am a big fan of philosophy and not necessarily a big proponent of hedonism per se. But isn't life made up of tiny, accumulated hedonistic thrills?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. A very apt name.
What's one of your thrills, Moodens?
One of my thrills?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, a moonlit walk on the beach, I think. Gentle lapping surf coming in. Starlit sky with a full moon rising. Warm Mediterranean breeze. Mm-hmm. And a beautiful woman on my arm. How can you go wrong with that?
Certainly living up to your username, indeed.
Oh, if only you knew.
Well, that makes for a better answer than, I don't know, man, the sun's rays are very warm on my skin. Moontons has to have an obsession with the moon, I do believe.
Question number five. What tags would your ideal audio have?
Mm-hmm.
It's a two-part question. And what tags would your ideal script have? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I don't see why LB would have any particular hidden motive behind the question. It's just a general question. Vague.
Subtle.
Yes,
very
indeed.
Subtle.
Barely,
yeah.
Indiscretion is his middle name, after all. What tags would my ideal audio have? Quite possibly the same that my ideal script might have, actually. So, I would say one, heavy story. Give me some of that. I am one of those people who watch or, lately, listen to porn for the plot. Yes, I'm not faking it. Just plot makes it sexier. It just give me well fleshed out characters. Give me nuanced situations in which they have been thrown in. Give me exploration of the human psyche and throw sex in it, and you've got me riding on my bed or wherever else I might be. So story heavy, but that's me right there. I have developed a taste for period pieces, so historic audios or different decades, or just something which is distinctive, something with a flair. It could be a particular premise. Just, I think we can keep coming back to that, the story of it all. Give me a good story and embellish it with sex.
Yes, yeah, I'd agree with you on that.
Now, I want to get specifics. If I'm listening to an audio, oh, how am I kidding? Just give me someone with that MDOM.
a woman of simple pleasures. Just.
Oh, I have the simple greatest taste on earth. I am only after the best. Yeah, an MDOM audio with a slight rough tug, some give me some mindfuck as well, and you are going to ruin me.
Such a delightful thought.
I am. I am more than anything a savage sexual, if I may say so. So having that side of me played with or positively assaulted is a huge turn on. I actually have a t-shirt that I made for myself with, it has Raphael's angels at the bottom and a slight thought bubble which says that great minds fuck alike. And I do believe that.
That should be your motto. That's definitely something. That is something to live by. this one next then. It's quite a complex question, one I hadn't thought of before. What is one hard to deal with thing in the recording, posting, editing, audio making process that you think lurkers and non-performers don't quite realise is difficult to deal with? So as a performer, I guess he's asking, if you're a lurker, what's something you wouldn't necessarily think was hard for the performer to do?
A few things, actually. First of all, the time that is put into an audio, a really well-made audio. Even audios which are relatively short or with an easy premise, it doesn't matter. There is always quite a bit of time that goes into it. And more than that, the second factor that should be taken into account is the fact that an audio, you can love creating an audio, but it can at the same time be quite tasking to performing. There have been some audios where after I've finished performing, I've just felt completely obliterated. I was actually panting. Yeah. I did feel my limbs going paralyzed. It takes a lot out of you in a way that you wouldn't have assumed that it would. You might have just assumed that someone just hits record and they go ahead, they record it, they leave it there, do some slight editing, upload it, but that's not really it. And there have been some brilliant scripts out there. And I know that I do cry in quite a few of my audios, so, but there have been a few scripts that did actually hit me quite powerfully emotionally, which is beautiful, which, don't get me wrong, it's a lot of fun. It's what makes it so entertaining for a performer as well. All I'm saying is that it's not as straightforward as one might believe it is. But so much fun still. So much fun. Despite what I said, pretty straightforward. I see a script, I fall in love with it. I read it a couple of times, I get a feel of the character. Because if there is something that I do not really admire, is having a wonderful script and just performing in a way which makes it exorbitantly obvious that you're just reading it. I want to provide my listeners with an experience. In that way, I want them to forget that it's me who is taking them on that experience, and I want them to be lost in the character I am portraying. So first of all, I will just read the script a couple of times, get a good feel, but I don't want to overdo it because I don't want to get too much in my head. That's happened once and I just couldn't be happy with anything that I produced, no matter how many I had recorded, so I just let that go. And beyond then, it's quite easy. I record everything in one take and I just lose myself in the script. Usually there's not much else to say there.
Excellent. I think this is part of why we enjoy it, isn't it? You know, getting lost in a script.
We certainly have been blessed by amazing content out there. And I know it is a cliche what they say, that we would be nothing without our script writers, but it's true.
It is very true. I mean, as somebody like you who predominantly does other people's scripts, I do very few improvisations. I wouldn't be performing if people didn't write the script.
Oh, just say you're nothing without me, since you filled all of my scripts so far, and there will be an album.
I'm nothing without you, sweetheart.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Shall we move on to another set of questions? Because that answers Elby's, I think. Some interesting questions there. And the next question that we have comes from Tenny Brissimus. If you were a goddess, well, of course you most certainly are. What would be what would be your domain? Wisdom, love, the seas, the dead, and what kind of offerings would you want your humble, willing followers to give you?
I would have to say it would be a tie, perhaps, between the search for knowledge and the love of the sea, which anybody who knows me even a little bit, it is apparent to them that those are my main two passions and my main two loves. So if I were to have a choice to make, that would be my domain. Now, what offerings would I want? That's another thing altogether. I think I would enjoy songs.
Songs.
I think songs played on the lyre, for instance, would make for glorious tribute.
Songs of the sea and storms into peaceful, calm waters.
Well, not always peaceful and not always calm. I read somewhere that there are three things that all men owe to fear: a moonless and starless night, a storm at sea, and the wrath of a quiet man.
It's always the quiet ones you have to watch out for.
Always. There's just something truly, truly dangerous and disquieting about seeing the transformation of someone calm and serene exploding in pure hot anger.
Mm.
To have pushed someone like that to their limit, I wouldn't want to be in that position of whoever might have done such a thing. But yes, as an offering, I would say songs. And perhaps gardenias would be an appropriate choice as tribute. If you've never smelt that particular flower, it is, they're white petals, and they smell as if you had combined night flowers as well as that cool sound that the sea carries with it.
Casting garlands on the waves.
Quite appropriate, I think.
I think you would make an absolutely stunning goddess of the sea. We would raise statues in honor of your name and play songs all night long. Worship at your feet.
Mm. Oh, I just want people to have fun, bottom line, you know. Just have fun and worship me, that's all I'm asking.
Just a little, you know, that's not much to ask for, is it? Just have fun and a little bit of worship. I can go for that. So the next questions we have are from Texan Guy. And he asks...
Ooh, our resident southerner.
He asks, what makes a perfect date? Could you describe to us what your idea of the perfect date would be?
Again, Tex, if you're interested, I mean... You can outright ask me, you don't need to be shy. But my perfect date would be... Well, honestly, I have a host of ideas that I could and will describe because you will get to hear me rambling on. But the thing is, a lot of it has to do with the appropriate company. I could describe the absolute ideal setting for myself. And yet with the wrong person, with someone that there is absolutely no chemistry with whatsoever, it would just be wasted.
Mm.
That having been said, however, I would say that a perfect date is a date which allows for two people to talk, so no movies and dinner.
I agree with you on that.
I would say the perfect date is a date which allows for the accumulation of knowledge about the other person. Something that isn't pressure-inducing, doesn't put you on the spot. And something which provides leeway for the accumulation of shared experiences. And that is something that two people can very easily bond over.
Mm-hmm.
So, a bookstore date, a gallery opening, a museum, a walk by the sea, or trying five different kind of cuisines when you're in the street food corner of a particular city. Pretend to be tourists rediscovering said city from scratch. Just being able to breathe in moments and breathe out experiences with one another, I think that will make for a lovely and fascinating date.
I think you would be an absolutely fabulous date.
So what's the next question? What else does Tex want to know?
The next question. Tex is going to tweak the fuck, marry, kill question and ask, if you had to choose from your favourite philosophers, who would you make king? Who would you want to be your teacher? And who would you order to drink hemlock?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Mm. Okay. Who would I make king? Hmm. go with the second question, actually, because that is one I can readily answer, I believe. Who would I want as my teacher? I would have to say Bertrand Russell.
Really? Why?
One of the major contributors to, if there is such distinction, the analytical philosophy wave. He did a lot to contribute in different branches of philosophy that had not actually existed, at least to that extent, prior to his own contributions, such as... So Russell essentially, if not founded, at least extended and contributed hugely to gnosology, which is one of my most beloved branches of philosophy. But more than that, and more importantly, he actually exhibited traits that you would want a teacher and a mentor to have with his own student, Ludwig Wittgenstein. When he felt that he had taught Wittgenstein enough, and when he was in awe of Wittgenstein's own mind and its inner workings, he had no qualms whatsoever to take a step back, to outright admit that the student had indeed become the master, to re-examine his own positions, his own thesis, pardoning afterwards what he had learned from his own student. So I think that is an admirable quality to find in a teacher, someone who's not afraid to let go of their authority, someone who's not afraid to admit that they are wrong and to continue evolving their ideas. So Russell would be my teacher, ideally. Who would I order to drink hemlock? Okay, a bit of a controversial answer perhaps, but Descartes. He's fine, and look, I just really, really hate the ontological argument, man. Just, what is that line of thought, honestly? And I know, I've read all of the arguments posted by philosophers, professional philosophers, if you want to call them that. Yes, I understand, but still, it bugs me. What sort of proof is it that you can just outright go and say, look, if God does exist, then he needs to be a perfect being, and an imperfect being cannot not exist. Otherwise, then that would besmirch their own perfection. That, to me, is just... It's not a valid philosophical argument. It is what would be called in ancient Greek, lipsi tuetumeno. It is just taking your position as is, holding it for granted, and then expanding upon it. But it's not actual truth. And that is why Descartes would get the hemlock.
So he's a pseudo-philosopher then, so entrenched in his own position that he's not prepared to give an inch, and he's got to go.
I wouldn't go as far as to call him a pseudo-philosopher. I'm sure there are other people out there who are quite closer to that term. Peterson.
excuse me. Right, carry on. This is another discussion.
Oh, yes, excuse me. That was... And who would I make king? Who would I make king? Oh, there's so many... Hello. I suppose that Camus would be an interesting choice.
Really?
But it also, before answering that, it's this part of the question is giving me a bit of trouble, because I just have to think, are we talking about the philosopher king as they are described in Plato's Republic? Are we talking about a more kind of king? Because I think the stance that you have to hold someone up to would change based on the definition that you would give to that particular role. A philosopher king owed to be the best of the best. They ought to be an example in all things. You could argue that a king also has to do that, but I do believe that the moral, at least, bar is a little lower in comparison. Personally, I'm a big fan of absurdism, which is potentially why I would choose Camus as a king. His book, The Myth of Sisyphus, was actually quite life-changing for me at one point in my life. And also, he's the proof that someone could be very hot and still be a philosopher. David Hume.
As king.
What's wrong with David Hume? Well,
what's right with him? As king. I'm surprised you didn't choose Socrates. I thought you would have.
Oh, Socrates would not be a good king. For a variety of reasons. Socrates would be a fantastic minister, for instance. But he would be a fantastic advisor to a king. Absolutely. But a king? No. This is a man who abhorred being held to a schedule. This is a man who loved to live life the way he wanted to. And he didn't want to have to shoulder every single responsibility that would potentially and surely come with one's reign. He would be a fantastic commander. He bantered like no other philosopher that I know of. When he was forced to drink hemlock before he died, he had the chance to escape imprisonment. His friends had arranged that. He said, however, that just because its city had wrongfully convicted him to death, it did not mean that he was going to break the laws of his own city. And thus, he just gathered his friends around, he drank the hemlock, and he conversed about the meaning of life and the possibility and brilliance of life after death. Also, when he was brought before a court to justify his behavior and see and test the appropriate punishment that befit him, as was the custom in ancient Greece at that time, he said that the only thing that befit a man such as himself, who would spend so much time trying to push the citizens of Athens towards the right path of virtue, the only thing that could possibly live up to his contribution would be for him to be put in the equivalent of the city house and to be fed for free. People in the court did not like that, hence why I think he was convicted to death. One of the many reasons.
Well, at least it was worth a try, wasn't it?
Oh, well, you have to admire a man who just never loses to hear their humor.
Yes, you do. Next question. What do you look for in a script?
I feel like I might have already answered that with Elby's question earlier, but it doesn't hurt to elaborate further on that. I look for a compelling story, first and foremost. I look for something other, different story-wise, or even sex being utilized in a different fashion. Something that, again, is able to provide the listener with a new sort of experience. There is nothing wrong with simple scripts, and there are times when I myself have turned to simple scripts because, you know, the basics are the classics for a good reason. Because they work, because they're enjoyable. But when I'm looking for something really challenging, I want exactly that. I want to challenge myself. And that doesn't mean that I like constantly portraying the same type of character again and again and again. I do love taking risks, and it is a lot of fun portraying someone who is potentially very, very far away from what I am like.
Yes.
Again, that calls for quite a bit of dramatic acting, but with a good script, you tend to get lost in the character as well as the story. And I would have to say that I have been astounded by the amount of quality scripts available on GWA, which is why I can honestly say that I have not regretted or ever felt meh about filling a particular script. I am thankful for each and every one of them.
Absolutely.
As cliche as that might sound, and as pandering as it might sound.
And his last question. If you could live in a fictional world, which would it be and why? And you get a bonus if you tell us which world would you choose to only vacation in?
Fictional world to live in. You know, with all of its darkness and cruelty and war, I would have to say the fantastical world of Stephen Erickson in his Miles and Book of the Fallen series.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a huge world. It is a huge world full of adventure and, yes, challenges and trials. But Erickson managed to portray the world with some different level of nuances, whether that has to do with religion or the way that magic works in that particular universe, or even the way that society has been structured in a way that it allows for both men and women and for virtually almost anyone of any class to be able to contribute to the entire story. And there's just something magical about that. Yes, there is death, but which world doesn't actually have death? And I did debate whether I should give Erickson's world as opposed to, say, Middle Earth. And even though I do love Tolkien, and I will always adore him as the father of fantasy, Erickson's world is the single greatest feat that I have myself experienced in the fantasy genre. Tolkien, as wonderful as he is, he, in my opinion, falls into a very specific trap of creating a very black and white fairy tale world quite often. That doesn't interest me as much. I don't want to be understood straight away. I don't want to people to say, oh, yes, she's a good one. So off with the good guys, off with the heroes, and then, oh, no, she's a baddie. Come on, push her into the darkness. That's not how it works. That's not how real life works. And I wouldn't want it to work that way either. It's the little different grey areas that make life what it is, that make the human aspect of life,
yeah,
as fascinating as that is, it doesn't come easy. But ultimately, when you look back, you don't want to think that all of your choices were obvious, because the good thing had always been obvious to you. I think in that way it would lose its significance. You want to be able to say that I thought long and hard on this, and it wasn't an easy choice, because it rarely is. But in the end, I did not regret the choices I made, because those were the right ones at the right time. Plus, Erikson's world has a glorious anthropological richness to it. The man was an archaeologist and an anthropologist, so he has incorporated a lot of that to also include some pre-Homo sapiens species and amazing civilizations and different caste systems and glorious deserts with hurricanes, but also glorious sea swarms. I don't know, it's fun. Okay, so Erikson's world it is. But which world would I choose to only vacation in? That would have to be... I have always been fascinated by Atlantis. The little part of me, the little girl in me, still kind of hopes that we will discover this sunken palace of a city at some point. And if we do, I'm right there.
So you don't believe we've already discovered it then?
No, I don't think so.
Well, according to some people, it's off the coast of Portugal, isn't it?
I am talking about, you know, the little dream of a huge civilization that, for whatever reason, was sunk under waves to be lost forever, to still maintain this air of mystery and this shroud around it. Which is very close to what happened to prehistoric Aegean Sea, of course, but civilizations that were not lost, yes. And we know very well why that happened. Big angry volcanoes is what happened.
Sounds like quite a fun vacation. You stay there for a couple of weeks, come back with some...
It is the epitome of a sea resort, isn't it?
It is, actually. Next, we have a set of questions from Arby Wren. And she asks, which author, living or dead, would you most want to write your biography?
Well, there are quite a few to pick from, I would say. One could entertain the idea of Harry Nietzsche. It being my own biography being an undoubtedly controversial and contradictory rendition would make it all the more likely to actually delineate a personal account of my history. Plus, his historical research has always been pretty bomb, so I'm sure he could dig up some juicy tidbits for all my fans.
Yes.
At the same time, I like Hemingway. I like that he presents significant things very simply. One could also say, go on.
You could say that. Doesn't he just have this habit of beating the poetry out of words and just leaving it stark and bare? I've never been able to get my head around Hemingway.
If you haven't read Movable Feast, then I can see why you would say that he beats the poetry out of words. But there is a music to his simplicity, I think. Another kind could be George R. R. Martin. Even though it can get really complicated and also be about every single person I've ever met and lineage dating back hundreds of years.
That would be a sweeping cast of characters, including the bloke you met on the train station who clipped your ticket one day.
But it would be fascinating nonetheless.
I'm sure it would.
But I don't know about a biography. I think it was Edmund White who said that happy people don't write books. But I do think that elegies are awesome. And I would not mind it if some poet used my death as fuel for a masterpiece like Milton preparing for Paradise Lost with Lycidas, or Shelley writing Adonai, or Once Keats Died. Probably Nabokov, because he can make boring stuff into incredible prose, or maybe even even Stone, since he did write some really good biographies, The Agony and the Ecstasy from Michelangelo and The Lust for Life from Van Gogh. But that having been said, it is another matter if I would like my biography to be written at all, because there is a question of privacy and how much powerful art is, not that I am one, but and how much art, privacy powerful artists should have. There is this question of if one becomes an important artist, specifically, for instance, of writers, because it just tends to apply to them more, do they lose some of the right to privacy? Keats definitely did not write his letters for us.
Mm.
And in fact, some of his letters clearly had the address and the person he was writing to written last, so that other people in the room when he was writing the letter couldn't see who he was writing to. But pretty much every single English-speaking student of theory or literature will read a Keats letter at some point.
Yeah.
I'm not an English student, I have read them all. Henry James famously burned some of his letters to keep people from reading them when he knew he was going to die. Virgil didn't think the Aeneid was good and made his friends promise to publish it, and his friend published it not long after he died. Have we benefited from Virgil, from Keats' letters, etc.? Yeah, absolutely. But does that justify a total exploration of so many poets and novelists' personal lives via their letters and manuscripts and such? I don't think I want a biography written about me, honestly. You know, unless I'm still alive and it'll get me a lot of money and I think it's worth that, maybe. But ideally, I would prefer to avoid the exhaustive probing.
Yes, probing can be very exhaustive, and I'm sure they would probe deeply and find all these skeletons in your cupboard, and it would make for some salacious reading. But you're quite right. Maybe a person's private life should remain private. Well, that got...
That's exactly what I say. It should be.
That got deep. Let's move on to the next question, which I'm not sure I understand, but okay. I'm sure it will make perfect sense to you. Analytic or continental? And as for that ranking, you'd be insane if Camus weren't at the top of the list. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. Wow.
Fret not, sweetheart. I am here to enlighten you. Before that, I do think I have already expressed my admiration for Camus. I mean, honestly, what woman wouldn't? And this is based completely on objective criteria, based on his work, of course. But if there has been a debate which was first sprung during the 20th century about which branch of philosophy, continental or analytic, is best, do I have the answer for you now? Analytic philosophy is heartless wordplay, divorced from any issue of even the slightest relevance to anyone but analytic philosophers, and written by people with severe Asperger's. Continental philosophy, on the other hand, is a branch of literature which aims to produce the longest series of rhetorical flourishes interconnected without support of any remark of substance, and it is usually practiced while inebriated on opium. Or that's what the partisans will tell you anyway.
So that makes it more accessible to the masses, does it?
Not exactly, not if you've ever read Hegel, at least. Actually, analytic and continental philosophy are two loosely connected movements which together come to describe most of the philosophy done during the 20th century. Analytic philosophy has its origins in various events of the early 20th century, in Russell and Moore's reaction to British idealism, in Russell and Whitehead's appropriation of Fraser's innovations in logic, and in the reaction to German philosophy, walked out in the Vienna Circle and the Berlin Circle. On the other hand, continental philosophy has its origins likewise in the early 20th century, especially in the existential reaction to Husserl, walked out by Heidegger, Sartre, and others. So, analytic and continental philosophy are then the traditions of philosophy which continued through the 20th century from these two starting points. Around the mid-20th century, both traditions were deeply affected by internal events. In analytic philosophy, this was a series of criticisms of the logical positivism, which had become its dominant expression. Criticisms associated, rightly or wrongly, with Kuhn, Goodman, and Sellars. In continental philosophy, this was similarly a series of criticisms of phenomenology. Criticisms offered under the rubric of post-structuralism by figures like Foucault, Derrida, and Lyotard. Rather unclearly, however, any 20th century tradition of philosophy, which is not analytic, especially if it has its origins on the continent, is sometimes grouped under the label of continental philosophy. So the Frankfurt School is often called continental, even though it represents a tradition of philosophy quite different from that which begins in phenomenology and extends through post-structuralism. So while there are a number of well-known caricatures of analytic and continental philosophy, it's not particularly easy to give an accurate account of the differences aside from the complicated one that I have just introduced.
Okay, so are they complementary?
I would say that they're just... You can't exactly differentiate between the two. You could in very broad strokes, but over the years they have become so convoluted. Continental philosophy can still use the tools which are mainly used in analytical philosophy and vice versa. They're both interested in the big concerns of philosophy, in epistemology, ethics, aesthetics, and metaphysics. They're both interested in philosophical reflection on the other institutions of culture, on science, religion, politics, and art. And they are both interested in philosophy's own history and methodology. They are both interested in pursuing a well-founded philosophical methodology suited to the aims and problem situation of philosophical inquiry. They're both interested in being relevant and substantial. It's the same inane distinction made between more traditional aspects of philosophy like rationalism and empiricism, which are movements which dominate early modern philosophy from around mid-17th to mid-18th centuries. They're in the historical background of both analytic and continental philosophy, and this period in history had been particularly influential for the self-conception of philosophers, so that one continues to hear references to rationalism and empiricism, indicating some positions with a family resemblance to those positions worked out by the movements in the early modern period. But this is also true in analytic and continental philosophy both. So I suppose that what I'm trying to say is that I feel like the distinction is of no consequence. I am a huge fan of existentialism, so I can't just say, oh yeah, fuck continental philosophers, no, they have contributed nothing to the world. But I'm also a huge proponent of gnosiology and the philosophy of science and linguistics as proposed by Frege and Russell and Wittgenstein. I think that one needs to stop with this silly debate that it just serves as a way to circle jerk in your own circle to say, oh no, I'm the better thinker, just make the most of the tools with which the human mind has been blessed, and subsequently they have evolved to a degree so we can torture ourselves with questions that potentially can never be proven, and that is the beauty of it.
Right. Perpetual suffering, trying to answer the questions that cannot be answered.
That is the true human condition, is it not?
Well, shall we move on then to question number three?
Absolutely.
Fill in the blank. I am the blank of GWA.
I am the sweet sorrow of GWA. And I think I'll leave it at that.
I think we will. A deep longing.
What are you of GWA?
What am I on GWA?
What's your blank? Yeah.
I am... Sorry, I was going to say I am the sword in the night, but I've suddenly got flashbacks to George R. Martin.
Don't you worry, I'm not picturing you like a tiny, adorable bat.
Oh.
All the bats have got a bad rep this year.
I am the music of the night, my sweetheart.
Mm.
Question number four. What is the one thing, if any, that you have learned from your experiences as a performer?
Simulating blowjob sounds is actually harder than giving a blowjob.
I can sympathize with that because cunnilingus sounds are cunnilingus sounds.
Because I was
going to
say that I've never heard
any
simulated blowjob sounds.
You've never heard? Oh, right. I once got a comment from someone who told me that her group of friends had been fervently discussing all afternoon what fruit I had used to make the cunnilingus sounds on one of my audio. And apparently it had become an obsession and they had to know. They thought it must have been a cantaloupe.
Is there a higher compliment than that? So what fruit was it?
It wasn't a fruit. It was just, well, I had... I don't want to give away any trade secrets here. You know, I know people use their own individual imagination, which is why it makes it so interesting, doesn't it?
Yes, because when I'm listening to you making,
I'm sure you
sound. Oh, so did he use a peach or a cantaloupe?
I have used a peach before, but that was more for vampiric sounds. They work particularly well for the sucking of blood.
Oh, everybody knows that if you're going to make a vampire audio, you just need to have a victim or two ready at disposal.
Yes, who's to say I haven't got
We need to suffer for our art.
I've got a willing victim in the wardrobe right now. I just drag her out every time I want to make an audio.
Well, you know, on a much less sexy note, I did read recently that someone went to an anime con at some point, a hentai con, that is, and apparently the way that they make this very intense squelching kind of sound is by having tuna salad punched. And it was very specifically tuna salad. Like, I can just imagine this bloke coming in on work one day and having brought a chicken salad instead because it was a misunderstanding. And everybody has to go home that day and everybody's angry because they missed a day of work, and the employers are quite angry because even though they didn't work that day, this union still has to pay them. So just all because a guy did not bring the right kind of salad.
Yes, we must make sure we have the right kind of salad. The search continues. We'll move on now to questions from Bear on a Mountain. So Mr. Bear asks, what does hedonism mean to you?
Well, the word hedonism comes from the ancient Greek for pleasure. Different kinds of hedonism, both psychological and motivational hedonism, claim that only pleasure or pain motivates us. I do not subscribe to the idea that pleasure alone by default is the only thing that should be taken into account, the only thing of value. Nature as Bentham, of all people, geez, I can't believe I'm quoting Bentham, but whatever. As Bentham has written, nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, both pain and pleasure. Now, do I disagree with Bentham? Yes, excruciatingly, but the thing is, I do believe that pleasure can be elevated and derived through pain. And this is not just a sex thing, although it does translate into sex. I take into account Hamulipi or Schadenfreude. Pain or displeasure is understood way too broadly if we are to just say that pleasure has to be whatever makes you feel good in very strict and narrow terms, as opposed to pain, which makes you feel bad or loathing. But for instance, melancholy is one would argue, technically speaking, a negative feeling. But isn't there such exquisite sadness in melancholia?
Yes, I guess there is. You're talking to an ex-goth here, so you know, we know all about wandering around being pale and interesting.
Oh, of course, I'm sure.
So, pleasure and pain can both be pleasurable in their own way.
I think that it absolutely has to be. I mean, I assume you're familiar with some of the greatest dystopian novels. For instance, 1984.
Yes.
It is very easy to understand that 1984 is a dystopia.
Mm.
It is meant to be easily understood as such, but I think that Aldous Huxley was actually the master in writing a dystopia with his novel The Brave New World. In this Brave New World, the world government uses advanced biotechnology and social engineering to make sure that everyone is always content and nobody has any reason to rebel. It is as if joy and sadness from the inside out of the Disney movie and the other characters in Raleigh's brain have been turned into loyal government agents. So there is therefore no need for secret police, for concentration camps, or for a ministry of love, a la Orwell's 1984. Indeed, Huxley's genius consists in showing that you could control people far more securely through love and pleasure than through fear and violence. Which is why reading Brave New World is a far more disconcerting and challenging experience. Because you are hard-pressed to put your finger on what exactly makes a dystopian. The world is peaceful and prosperous, and everybody is supremely satisfied all the time. So, what could possibly be wrong with that?
Too and yet, perfect.
Yet that is a question which is addressed in the novel in the form of John Savage. And I'm not going to bore you with quoting long literary excerpts, but at some point, John the Savage says that the tears are necessary. That we need to remember what Othello said, that if after every tempest comes such calms, may the winds blow till they have wakened death. You have to have sorrow to embolden pleasure. Otherwise, an exorbitant amount of pleasure, much like anything else in life, loses its core value. I don't, much like John the Savage, I don't want comfort. As he says, I want God, I want poetry, I want real danger, I want freedom, I want goodness, I want sin. By claiming the right to feel pain, by claiming the right to be unhappy, you're claiming the right to feel alive, to what tender and near and dear, to live with integrity, to survive, to explore and improve ourselves.
Mm.
So this is my very roundabout way of answering this question.
I could subscribe to that view. Okay. Pleasure and pain go hand in hand. You can't truly know one unless you know the other.